Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Regina.
Hi, Kai.
So in the last couple of weeks, we've been talking a lot about a certain term on our team.
Yeah, Afrofuturism.
Right, which is suddenly everywhere, it seems like.
Right, exactly. It's everywhere. But what does it mean? What does Afrofuturism look like? What does it sound like? And how does it speak to the Black experience?
Being Black is like a science fiction experience, right? In which aliens came and took you from your planet and brought you to another planet forcibly. Lee Perry, Sun Ra, George Clinton, in very different ways, told that story in their music.
Well, tonight on the United States of Anxiety, we celebrate Black History Month with a journey into Afrofuturism.
So it is Black History Month, and we're asking people around the park, have you ever heard of the term Afrofuturism?
I've never heard of the term. I'm sorry.
Yes, I have.
I have heard of Afrofuturism.
How would you define it?
The idea of an Afrocentric world in the future.
A forward-thinking look.
Explores different ways of technology and future and how one involves in a social political climate.
It's about the importance of, because we focus a lot on like Black history, but also like Black futures are important too. And I think it's just about focusing on that.
And who comes to mind for you?
Like Sun Ra or like Janelle Monáe.
Big Janelle Monáe fan.
I would say Octavia Butler.
I first researched the term because of a theater company. They were these two amazing Black women that were part of their resident program. They were creating an Afrofuture work. And so when I saw their work, I was like, oh, what is Afrofuturism?
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright, and we're going to start our journey into the ideas and sounds and sights of Afrofuturism by meeting one of the most influential visual artists working today. Or that's my assertion anyway. Over the past decade, Hannah Beekler has been creating these beautiful, complex, unapologetically Black worlds on film. Among her other projects, she's been the production designer behind Moonlight, Fruitvale Station, Beyoncé's Lemonade, and perhaps most famously, Marvel's Black Panther. That film made her the first Black person to be nominated for and to win the Academy Award for Best Production Design. And now she has lent her eye to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she has curated a new Afrofuturism period room, which is yet another historic first. And given all of that, she seems like exactly the right person to tell us what Afrofuturism looks like. Hannah, welcome to the show, and happy Black History Month.
Happy Black History Month.
So for you, what is Afrofuturism?
You know, I think there's a lot of different definitions, but for me, Afrofuturism is sort of a reimagining of a history, right? It's sort of like going back and reclaiming how history has seen Africans and African Americans throughout time. So it's sort of this idea that the past, the present, and the future is not linear, but circular in a sense. Our present is influencing our future, is influencing our past. So it's just sort of the playing with time and how we sort of retell our own stories with our own agency.
Mm. Well, you are the lead curator for the new Afrofuturist period room at the Met. And it is this fascinating illustration of everything you're just talking about. And people who visit the exhibit step into a speculative future home of the residents of what was once Seneca Village. So can you introduce listeners to Seneca Village?
Yeah, Seneca Village was a predominantly Black, also Irish community in Manhattan, where Central Park is. So it was a lot of freed Black men and women, born free as well as freed slaves, who kind of escaped the, city, if you will, of New York and moved into a more rural area and started a community called Seneca Village, almost where the Met is located. It's probably about a 10-minute walk from the Met.
Right.
So in the 1800s, Seneca Village was about 1827 to 1857, so right before the Civil War. And if you owned land as a freed Black man or woman, well, both. Mm-hmm. You had to have spent $250, and then you had the right to vote. So Seneca Village was built up over time where they had schools, churches, homes, and was starting to be excavated in 2011, I believe. So they're finding these pieces of these lives. So, you know, a lot of people ended up selling their property. The state took the land by eminent domain.
It had been a thriving community of people.
Yes.
And it was taken by the state.
You know, there was probably about 300 people. And the way they took it was by, and many of the same sort of idea that was happening around a lot of Black communities at the time is by saying that they were the slums and it would be better if they took them down and made this beautiful park because this was an eyesore. But that wasn't the truth. Mm-hmm. And this exhibit was sort of an homage to the people, to the idea of community, of a protopian society, and a conversation of the past and the future and the present around Seneca Village and what it meant.
How did you even, just as a designer, begin to imagine this collapsing of past, present, and future of a place like that?
Well, you know, I just sort of thought about what are the things in a home? Because really, these communities are about home. These communities are about wanting the things that everybody has. Family, a safe place, love, peace, and a place to thrive where you are wanted. And that's where I started. Mm. And for me, that's the kitchen. Because so much of Black culture, me living in New Orleans and looking around at my neighborhood, and it's a lot about food, it's a lot about being neighbors, it's a lot about tradition. In New Orleans, we still have these 100-year-old traditions. I wanted to start there. That's where I remember getting my hair hot combed, you know, and, you know, getting the grease behind my ears and people being in the kitchen and cooking and me being on my mom's skirt and the steam coming off of the stove and the conversations and the arguments and my brothers and sisters and I having water fights. And the kitchen is really where life happens. Yeah. And I wanted to show that as part of what maybe Seneca Village could be like. That's how you're going to know these people as people.
We aren't able to walk through it together because of the realities of life and a pandemic and all the rest. But maybe we can do a virtual tour together here with listeners. And I should say, there's a visiting guide on the Met's website. So for podcast listeners, at least you can pause and go find that if you want to take a look around with us as we do this. But let's start in that kitchen that you're describing, Hannah. Tell me about some of the choices you're making there. Like, what would you direct my eye to first?
I think the first thing that I would hope that people would do when they walk in is look through our windows. So on the sides of the structure, there's different size windows sort of sporadically placed and at different heights. And I did that because for me, looking into what is the past for a lot of African Americans, not all, but most, and a lot of Africans in the diaspora, we only get a little piece of that past. You only see so much. Mm-hmm. And I wanted everyone to sort of have this experience. There's everything inside that room, but you only get to see a little sliver of it. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of how, being African American, I've experienced my life, only knowing slivers here and there. And then it's very subjective as to who is looking and which way they're looking. Mm. The other thing in this room, the big thing in the room is the fireplace, which is right in the center.
The big hearth.
And it kind of twirls up into the rafters, which has concentric circles around it. And this is our time machine. This is bringing all the beautiful artifacts that you see from Roberto Lugo, from Fabiola Jean-Louis, from Atang Tikshari, are beautiful chairs that he's made that Fabiola's beautiful paper dress is sitting in. The dress, to me, is representative of the woman who lives in this, and she is sitting, she is at rest, her body is at rest. And that is an important piece to me, because so often we're deemed as strong and warriors and working right. And fighting. And
the mules of the world, rarely, as Zora Neale Hurston tells us.
That's right, at rest, yeah. Sitting. And looking over the future that we protect with our time machine. So, you know, and a lot of it is me wanting people to come in and just have their own experience. Both ends are open because you can only see the future through the past, and you can only see the past through the future. And the precipice where our body is sitting sits between them both. That is our present. That's sort of how this room is laid out.
You mentioned that Roberto Lugo, this Philadelphia artist, Roberto Lugo, there's a lot of his pottery in the exhibit. And there's one it's kind of like an urn, I think, that has a portrait of Harriet Tubman on one side and Erykah Badu on the other. Tell me about that urn. It sounds like it's, and what it's doing in that room, because it sounds like it's doing a lot of what you're talking about.
It is. It's a conversation. And I think that that's... representative of so much. Roberto wanted to really bring in powerful, strong women in our past, in our future, and all the things that they represented of freedom, of choice, of agency. These are conversations we've been having, right? These are conversations that are cyclical. So to me, that represents sort of where we are, where we're going, and the fight and the struggle to stay there.
You said earlier that going back to the window, you said that for you, your experience with Black history is only being able to see a little bit of yourself. Can you say more about that? What do you mean by that?
Well, I feel like personally, I don't really know about my past, my ancestors, my relatives. You know, it seems as though it sometimes people kind of think like African Americans sort of like popped up in cotton fields and here we were. Mm-hmm. And our past, the history that we teach, really doesn't teach beyond that. I never really understood my connection with Africa. Or do I have a connection with Africa? I don't know who my ancestors right. were here. They could have come from the Dominican Republic, and they could have come from South America. I don't really know this. So anything I learn, every time I learn something, it's like looking into a little window and seeing more. Like I'm walking in a cave with a flashlight, and every occasionally you get something on the wall. And I wanted that experience. I wanted everyone to understand, like, when you're walking around the world really not knowing everything about your past, like, I can't just go back and be like, I came from France and mm-hmm. came over and, you know, I don't know. I know a lot of people had to survive for me to be here.
Yep, yep.
So that was the window. That was the idea of the windows. Everybody experienced that you see only so much.
Yeah. Well, back on our tour, when you move into the living room area, that one of the things that I'm struck by, we've talked about a lot of the pottery and stuff, but there are lots of images as well in this space. And I'm really drawn to the portrait of Andrea Motley Crabtree, who is a real human who I did not know about. She's the first woman and first Black woman to be a deep sea diver in the U.S. Army. And she's depicted here. She's sitting, but done up in this fantastical diving gear. I just so drawn. Tell me about this work.
When I first saw this work, when the Met had presented it to me and said, this would be something that's great in the room, it's part of their collection. And I thought, oh, she's an astronaut. I'm like, yeah. That is so cool. You know, Afrofuture, I'm thinking of space. I'm thinking of this time continuum. And then they explain, like, you know, she was the first Black woman to be a deep sea diver. And it made so much sense at that point because we know so little about the ocean. We know so little about space. We know so little about ourselves and our journey. It's all kind of wrapped up in the same sort of feeling of flight and weightlessness. Then I really wanted that that you could stand in the very back by the kitchen and look all the way through and you see the time machine, you see Fabiola's dress, and then you see this beautiful portrait. Mm-hmm. And that line that it creates through this space from and one end to another, from the past to the future, that past is the future. This Black woman is the woman in space. That is who I look at the stars every night and see. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted that there.
And so, Hannah, after someone has experienced this space, what is it you hope they take away as they walk out?
Joy. Mm. Black joy. My mission is to teach Black joy before Black pain. No child needs to learn that first. I learned that first. And so I want people to walk in, and what you see is joyful. What you experience through the pain is joyful. You know, we put hundreds of iron nails in the side of the structure, and they had asked me why, and I said, because iron is so important. It is the thing that shackled us, and it's the thing that freed us. Mm. Wow. I want this to be like that. I want this, the thing, to be the freedom.
I'm talking with Hannah Buechler about the exhibit she curated for the Metropolitan Museum called Before Yesterday, We Could Fly, an Afrofuturist period room. Hannah's many credits as a designer include the film Black Panther, for which she won an Oscar for Best Production Design. We'll take a break and we'll talk more with Hannah about her career and about collapsing the future with the past. Stay with us.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and we're celebrating Black History Month this week by learning about Afrofuturism. And its idea that the past, the present, the future, they're all together in one thing. I've been talking with Hannah Buechler, who curated the Metropolitan Museum of Art's new period room on Afrofuturism, and who, as a production designer, has been the visual artist behind some of the most remarkable films featuring Black lives in recent years. We're talking about Moonlight, Creed, Beyoncé's visual album Lemonade, Fruitvale Station, which was, of course, the wrenching biopic of Oscar Grant. The list goes on, but I had to ask her about her Academy Award-winning work creating the Afrofuturistic world of the Black Panther film. Just tell me about working on that film. It meant so much to so many Black people, and I just wonder what it meant for you.
It meant so much to this Black woman. It was big, and I knew it was bigger than me. You know, I just felt compelled to to do this, you know? And then there was a lot of drive for that. And I have, of course, Mr. Ryan Coogler to thank, right, for having the opportunity to put on screen what I felt was so important for people to see a fictional Black nation to be, what it could be. Mm-hmm. And so it was daunting. I mean, I walked in and I wasn't quite sure what what it was. And Ryan was like, okay, so I need to know how many people there are. What do they do? Where do they live? Tell me everything about the country. Where do they go? How do they drive? What are the streets? What are the stories? And I was I have to tell you all. I can't just make a pretty set. And so it was start building the world. Mm. And I just dug in and I started from scratch. And how do you build a world? You start with where is it? What is it? How big is it? Where does the country look like? What is the environment? What is the climate? Where is the capital? Now, how many people? How did they get there? Where did they migrate from? Why did they migrate there? What do they specialize in? How does their tradition evolve to be 50 years in the future from the West? What is the timeline? We built a whole timeline that shows you Wakanda from the Bronze Age to the present.
And it started with Black joy. It's also like I'm thinking about what you said previously. It's rooted in Black joy.
Absolutely. So we did the work, and I'm not going to lie, it was scary. You know, it's a big movie. It's a big company. I was just coming off of Creed, which was nowhere near that size. You know, I did this big presentation with all of the execs over at Marvel. I was scared to death. And my advice from Ryan was just be yourself. And I went in and I was, you know, I was loud. I was excited. yes. And I wanted them to see that that this Black woman can handle this big budget, handle a large crew, and be creative and pragmatic and give them everything they want. But my main concern was making sure that I was doing right by my community in the diaspora and in America, because I am an African-American. That is my experience. So I, you know, put a little bit of that experience into this African nation as well. But I just wanted to make sure I was doing right by everybody.
Well, you truly handled it, in fact. But our producer pointed me to an IndieWire article in which you said that the first decade of your production work in your career was a real struggle and that you almost left the business.
It was a real struggle. I mean, when I started out, and I started out as a set dresser in the art department, and I worked my way up through all the different crafts in New Orleans. And you just get to the place where it felt like Hollywood was 1,000 miles away, and it was, physically as well as, you know, figuratively. And no one knew my name, and how am I going to get out there, and how am I going to get these other jobs? And Wynn Thomas, who is a mentor of mine, Spike Lee's production designer for his entire career, you know, I called Wynn, like, I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to start finding something else. And, you know, I thought he was going to feel sorry for me and pity me. And he said, well, you need to get your damn ass up and get back in the business. Like, there is no crying. You know, I don't care what you say. You're not leaving. Stand up, brush yourself off. And that's it, girl. Stop. And I, you know, it kind of took me back like, okay.
Let me stop.
He was
too.
Not playing around with me. He was like, you're not going to get a little pity party if that's what you're looking for. It's hard.
Yeah.
So go work.
Yeah. Well, and so you went to work, and eventually you connected with at the time, 25-year-old Ryan Coogler. He is obviously a massive figure at this point, but this was his breakout moment as well. And the start of your collaboration with him was the film Fruitvale Station. Which was a pivotal film for me, I have to say, in terms of trying to look at Black pain and Black joy at the same time. It was just such a difficult film to watch. Tell me about working on that project. What was that like?
I mean, that changed everything. So after Wynn kind of, you know, got me together, collected me a little bit, he said, go get an agent. I did. And the first script they brought to me was Fruitvale Station. I read it. I cried my eyes out. And I said, I want to do this film. I had a meeting with Ryan, and he hired me the same day. And like a few months later, I drove out to Oakland and dog sat so I could work on the dog sat. And I became a different person and a different filmmaker having worked with Ryan on that film. Everything I thought I knew changed. about how to tell a story. Mm. He taught me perspective. He taught me storytelling visually, and that the place that we're in is as important as the story itself. And that's where I would come in, the place. Mm-hmm. And he taught me all about that because of his love for Oakland, yeah. because of his love for Black people, yeah. because of his love for Black joy, mm. and the need to tell this story. And it was not easy. It was really a difficult, emotional story to get through. And so it takes a toll on all of us. We were working 22-hour days at that point. So we were also exhausted trying to get this done with very little money, but trying to do the absolute best we could. There was me plus one other person in my department.
Wow.
So I kind of did everything. But I just watched Ryan, and he blew me away. And I knew, I can remember saying to his family, nothing will ever be the same for him after this, ever again. You are watching the rise of an important filmmaker in the history of film. Like, that took me, by the end of the film, I knew that's what I was watching. Right. Now, if he was ever going to call me again or not, I don't know.
Right, but you knew him and Michael B. Jordan were about to go someplace. Well, luckily you did too. You and I are talking now not only amid Black History Month, but just after Trayvon Martin's birthday. Yes. He would yes. have been 27 years old this month. He was killed 10 years ago. This month also began with Amir Locke being killed by police in yet another no-knock raid in Minneapolis. And it may be a silly question to ask you, but, you know, in the context of all that has happened since Fruitvale Station, what do you feel like art like that film can do about this anti-Black violence? What is its role in responding to these awful moments?
Humanity. Mm. What Fruitvale Station did was show people Oscar's humanity. He is a human being first, and that is so important. Though Moonlight wasn't about police violence or brutality, it was about a different type of brutality, and I believe it did the same thing as show humanity, and those are so important in Black cinema, the complexities of Black people, that we aren't a monolith, that we are individuals, we are humans, not just sons, daughters, aunts, uncles, we are humans. We don't have to be these other things in order to be seen as human, and that's what Ryan wanted to say. That was the importance of the scene with the pit bull. Mm. And Ryan and I talked about that and talked about that and talked about that and struggled with that scene. But at the end of the day, you know, he said, looked at me and he said, oftentimes Black men are looked at like pit bulls. You can run them down in the middle of the road and keep going. They are the not needed of society. They are the danger of society. And to show Oscar with that pit bull, holding that pit bull, was such an important scene. And I think kind of rounded out in the height of the humanity within this young man for whatever mistakes he made, for whoever anyone thought he was someone's son, and he was a person, and he was killed. And I stood over the bullet hole in the BART station at Fruitvale Station and looked at it. And we stood around it with Ryan and held hands, and he prayed. That's how hard that film was to do. And that's why those films are important.
As a consumer of this work, it feels to me like Fruitvale Station was the beginning of this movement in Black film. Is that what it feels like to you as well? And if so, how would you describe it?
Absolutely, it feels like that to me. Sometimes I feel like I just got swept up in this moment that I'm so grateful and blessed for. And it was a moment, and I knew it was coming in a weird way. It's this moment of reckoning. And film is such a powerful medium, right? That I think people were suddenly seeing like this, it's time for us to tell our stories and fighting for that. This generation of young people that have come in and made these films have been fighting for this. And, you know, it's the springboard of Spike Lee. It's the springboard of John Singleton. It's the springboard of Antoine Fuqua and F. Gary Gray. And you go back and back and back even further, right? And I'm quite proud of that. This work, this body of work, from working with B and Barry Jenkins and Ryan, of course, it feels like, truthfully, I don't often say, sometimes, like I'm just this general that's protecting my people, protecting the story. Because I'm a fighter, I'll tell you what, I make sure that people aren't going to play games and silliness when we're making these movies. Okay. That the nuances that aren't usually there, that people don't usually know, are there because it's my experience, it's part of my community. And I stand strong and firm between what you see on the screen and what you might have seen on the screen. I make sure it's there, that people can see themselves in a real way, in a genuine way. Not the way people want to see us, but the way that we are in all of our complications, messiness, and joy. So I see myself as, you know, these filmmakers coming to me because they know that I'll stand strong for that. And I'll dig as deep as I have to dig and do the research until I can't see straight to make sure that it's right. Because I'll tell you what, I don't know if I can cuss, but I'll be goddamn if it's going to not be something that's going to make these stereotypes continue. No more of this perpetuation. I need people to see us as individuals. That we all do these different things. It's not just like, oh, well, sports and music.
Right, right.
That's what y'all are. It's like, no, man.
We are human beings. We are differentiated human beings.
All the way through. And that's sort of how I saw my role in this moment that's happening and why it's art department and production design to paint, right? To paint our world for the story. And that's what I think I'm doing. But I am, in a way, a guardian of that world. And that's how I sort of feel, you know.
Before I let you go, I want to play a little bit of your acceptance speech at the Academy Awards. So setting aside the fabulous bold red gown you were wearing, which, I mean, yes. It was emotional and really quite inspiring in the way you gave thanks. And here's the end of it.
I'm stronger because of my family who supported me through the roughest of times. I give the strength to all of those who come next to keep going, to never give up. And when you think it's impossible, just remember to say this piece of advice I got from a very wise woman. I did my best, and my best is good enough. Thank you.
So tell me about this moment for you, Hannah. Who gave you that advice?
You know, Victoria Alonso, who is the president of Marvel, my second day, she said, you know, come to my office, let's talk. And she knew I was nervous. She knew this was new for me. And I'm in this big world right now that, you know, I'm biting off a big chunk. And she wanted to make sure I understood that she was there to support me. And as we went through this film, I'd call her when I was feeling overwhelmed, or I'd call her when I needed a lift. And I was always very, it's not right, it's not perfect, it's not perfect, it's not perfect, it can be more perfect, I need this to be more perfect. She said, no, it's beautiful, it's great, it's not good enough, Victoria. I have to do more, what more can I do? And she said, you have to say this to yourself every day. I did my best, and my best is good enough. And I've never really thought that way before. So I wrote it on a post-it and I put it on a mirror and I said that every day. I did my best and my best is good enough. Because I needed to understand that. I needed to learn that. And I needed to sort of step away from this, you know, twice as hard for half as much mentality. My best is good enough. And whether that's twice as hard or not, it's just who I am and this is my best. And she taught me that. And that's where that came from in the speech, you know. And I wanted to make sure I said that because I wanted other young women, other young girls to be able to say those words to themselves. Because oftentimes as a woman in a man's world, your best is never good enough and you keep pushing and pushing, and you'll push yourself until, you know, you're not healthy anymore. Mm-hmm. And I say that to myself every day, and I'm a little bit more laid back, you know, working on Black Panther 2 right now. And it's not quite as intense for me. It's like, everything has to be perfect. But I'm more at ease in my role, and I'm a little more confident than I was the first time.
Well, Hannah, your best has not only been good enough, it has been a true blessing to me and to so many of us consuming your work. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And thank you for this time.
Thank you so much.
Hannah Buechler won an Academy Award for Best Production Design for Black Panther in 2019. She curated the new Afrofuturist period room at the Metropolitan Museum. It's called Before Yesterday, We Could Fly. You can preview it on the Met's website. And up next, what does the Afrofuture sound like? Stay with us.
Hey everyone, this is Kusha. I'm a producer. We just heard Hannah Buechler talk about what it was like being a first as a Black woman, winning an Oscar for her production design, her leadership in the massive Marvel franchise. And it connects to our episode last week when we talked about the nomination of a Black woman to the Supreme Court. We asked for your perspective. If you're a Black woman, what does the Supreme Court news mean to you? A listener named Casey sent us this message.
I'm not really impressed with President Biden's plan to have a Black woman on the Supreme Court. If anything, it just lets me know how much she doesn't quite understand about the systemic barriers that we face in this country. And it seems quite performative to me, especially as a Black woman and especially as a Black professional. I'm very aware of what it's like to be the first, the few, the only. And that puts a lot of pressure on one human being, not to mention a lot of the obstacles and barriers we face when we're in those positions and what that does to us and our well-being, our mental health, especially at this time when we're talking about putting more and more women into these positions. I don't think enough consideration is being placed on, okay, so how are these institutions changing so these people can thrive, not survive, but thrive in these roles?
Thanks, Casey, and everyone who's listening and talking to us. If you've got something to share, send us a message. Record yourself on your phone and email us. The address is anxiety@wnyc.org. Again, that's anxiety@wnyc.org. And thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. We're talking about Afrofuturism this week, and I'm joined by our producer, Regina Dehir. Regina, hey.
Hi, Kai.
So you wanted us to have a conversation about music. Why is that?
So it wasn't until we started working on this episode and I realized that some of the inspiration for the artists that I have now come to love and their seemingly groundbreaking choices were actually odes to artists that were really popular in the past that I just had never come across.
Right, right. Like who? Like which new artists are you talking about?
I'm thinking of Janelle Monáe is an obvious one. That's just the way you make me feel. But also like Thundercat, Flying Lotus. Do you know any of these artists, Kai?
I mean Janelle Monáe, but don't be trying to make me sound old. but no, I don't know those artists.
All right, well, regardless, I came across this really rad playlist called Afrofuturism, and it had even more interesting music that I hadn't heard before. Turns out the playlist was curated by Louis Chide Soki, who is the director of African American Studies at Boston University. And you know, we helped curate a music festival on Afrofuturism, which includes one of my favorite artists right now, Flying Lotus. The festival is running right now at Carnegie Hall, so I thought we had to meet Louis.
Hi, Louis. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for your interest in this.
So it feels like Afrofuturism, at least as a label, is suddenly everywhere, or at least more people, or it's legible to many more people. But of course, it's not a new idea. And the term was actually coined by a white man, as I understand it, in the 1990s.
Yeah, Mark Derry is a remarkable cultural critic and thinker who, in 1997, articulated the term, but as a provisional term. When he called it Afrofuturism, he actually said, for lack of a better term.
Oh, wow.
And for him, it was just an acknowledgement that a lot of people were having, that there was this coming together of a number of themes pertaining to African-American and Black peoples in the diaspora that was trying to understand their relationship to America, to the world, to the modern world, by way of science fiction, technology, right? And in the musical world, you know, Black musicians have always been pioneers in technology, but by the 70s and the 80s, and certainly by hip-hop and techno, it seemed as if the technology was foregrounded to a certain point that we, in a way that we hadn't seen before. Mm-hmm. And so for Mark Derry and others, Greg Tate, the much lamented Greg Tate, who just passed away a short while ago, there was something going on. There was an awareness of not just music and rhythm and lyrics and all of that stuff that Black people are noted for, but there was a deliberate technological superstructure at work. And this was also happening with an obsession with comic books. Black comic books.
Right.
And as well as different kinds of music that were deliberately focused on sampling and new forms of technology. So you got record album covers with, you know, laser beams and spaceships, et cetera, right? We got George Clinton in the mix and all these other figures, right? And by 1997, Mark Derry goes, let's just call it for now Afrofuturism. And though he meant it as a provisional term, it stuck.
It stuck. We're going to talk about some of those specific artists and some of those specific laser beams. But in general, is there, applying it to music, is there a certain instrumentation or rhythms or other musical characteristics that you'd say this is definitive of Afrofuturistic music?
Well, the thing about Afrofuturism, because it's becoming so widespread, one wants to be cautious in being definitive. But as someone who's been involved and around it or adjacent to it for quite a while, it initially is the music that not only uses tropes and images of science fiction and space travel and outer space, it's actually the musicians who deliberately engage technological sound making. Like Sun Ra, the great prophet of Afrofuturism, was also one of the early musicians to use the analog synthesizer. And he used analog synthesizers in jazz, which at the time, although we had the electronic music that was emerging in jazz, you know, Miles' Electronic Period and Herbie Hancock, right? Sun Ra was doing that stuff before anyone. And it was kind of heretical, you know? You've got him with the analog synthesizers. You've got Detroit techno, which a lot of people still think of as a white musical form. It comes out of young Black, you know, I want to say kids, but that's because I'm 54 now and everybody's a kid. But young Black people in the 80s using samplers and drum machines. Right? It comes out of Jamaica and the use of Casio tone keyboards to create digital rhythms. Right? So when I listen to the music of Afrofuturism, I tend to focus more on those who engage studio technology and new kinds of technologies, sometimes in ways that were unexpected. You hear people who are deliberately trying to sound machinic, like, but at the same time be funky with it. So for me, that's very much a characteristic of a lot of Afrofuturist sound making.
In preparing for this episode, I was so enjoying diving into the music. And when you mentioned Sun Ra, I think of the Outer Space Employment Agency and that video and that song.
We're opening up the doors of the Outer Space Employment Agency.
But for those who are unfamiliar like I was, what was Sun Ra's place in the Afrofuturism discussion?
Yeah, one tries to stay away from defining an origin to things, but it's hard not to consider Sun Ra the origin. He wasn't the first to have these themes and ideas, right? I'm a literary scholar and a writer, so I know about themes of Black science fiction that go back to the early 20th century, right? They weren't Afrofuturist, but they're now a part of the canon that's emerging of Afrofuturism. But Sun Ra, you know, brother from the deep segregated South, says he's from Saturn.
Well, they're kind of the same thing. I don't know.
Right? Brother from the deep segregated South comes out of big band jazz and picks up the analog synthesizer and starts thinking about Saturn, about Black people being aliens in our own, not even in our own country, just aliens. We don't belong here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? He's coming also in the context of this Black Pan-African narrative that argues that Black people are a part of a bigger world and participating in a broader diaspora. Well, Sun Ra was like, well, my diaspora is even broader than that. It's cosmic.
It's almost like I think about, you know, when you talk about the Deep South and the idea that this Black people as subhuman, yes, and him arguing we are suprahuman.
Exactly, exactly. And he says this very clearly, and this is why Sun Ra is such an important figure, Regina. He articulated these things. He had a full developed worldview. Right? For example, he would say, we have no rights in this society, so clearly we're not real.
Mm.
We are myths. Mm. We are myths that white people have. Right? Mm. Right? So if we are myths, how do we create a different myth that we belong to, participate in, and can draw from? And so although a lot of people in Afrofuturism or who feed Afrofuturism have the themes in their work, Sun Ra turned it into an ideology.
Yes.
That was very much in conversation with Pan-Africanism, Black power, and so many things. So that's why he's so crucial, on top of just crazy music and the stage shows and the films, right? And this whole magical worldview that really is asking Black folk, are we also not imprisoned by the logic of Western culture?
Right.
Right? Don't we have access to something else, another way of thinking about ourselves in the world?
Mm. And when you say that kind of stuff, we can't have that conversation without talking about Grace Jones also, who is a hero in my household.
Oh, yeah, mine too. Mine too.
You know, you've got her on your playlist. She's Lost Control. And it, you know, and everything about her and that song makes me think about these more modern artists, Lil Nas X, Janelle Monáe.
Oh, yes.
Playing with the sounds the way you're talking about, but then also the visual, like what we see.
All due respect to Madonna and people like that, Madonna gets a lot of the credit that Grace Jones deserves. You know what I'm saying, right?
Indeed.
A lot of this is Grace Jones. The visual, I mean, the line from Grace Jones to Lil Nas X is pretty clear. But they're drawing from not just a Black, fantastical, you know, performance imaginary, right? They're also drawing from a Black queer discourse that goes all the way back to the 70s in disco. And Grace Jones was so crucial because She's Lost Control is a post-punk song, right? That song is her doing a cover of a post-punk song. And so she's bringing post-punk, dub reggae, disco, queer culture, and the sometimes notoriously homophobic dubbed Jamaican culture, right, into one big pile. You can't not think of Lil Nas X in terms of country, hip-hop, and this very extravagant sort of queer performance. Right? I think Grace Jones made a lot of that possible. And it's Afrofuturist in that if you look at Grace Jones's videos from back in the day, it was all about the sort of man-machine. She had that man-machine thing, right? And a lot of angles where she just had everything looked like a robot. She was very clearly playing with this stuff, even though the word it did not exist. Slave to the Rhythm is a great example of all of this.
I mean, since we're just bringing out names, I just have really personally been enjoying Flying Lotus.
Who just sold out the Carnegie Hall show.
Oh, wow. Yeah. All right.
I could definitely see where that could happen. I mean, his song, Never Catch Me, with Kendrick Lamar is one of my favorite songs to just get lost in. I can see the darkness in me and it's quite amazing. Life and death is no mystery and I want to taste it. Step aside of my mind and you'll find curiosity, animosity, high velocity, I can prophesize meditation. And he's having such an astronomical impact on the industry right now, collaborating with the biggest names in hip-hop like Kendrick, Anderson .Paak, Thundercat, while also doing sound design for a lot of really major shows.
Yes.
And that's just so exciting to see. But I had no idea that his aunt is the great Alice Coltrane.
Yeah.
You know, the first Flying Lotus records that I heard had harp loops in them. And I just automatically assumed it was him looping his aunt, right?
Oh,
because,
wow.
You know, Alice Coltrane, she played the harp, amongst other things.
Yeah.
But listen to his first record. You hear a lot of harp loops in the mix. And I've never been able to confirm this, but even if they're not directly looped from his aunt, is a reference to his aunt, who was known for playing the harp, as well as Dorothy Ashby, another important Black woman who really funked out the harp back in the 70s. I would say that Alice Coltrane, John Coltrane, to a lesser extent, they very much feed into the Afrofuturist imaginary, because a lot of Afrofuturism is not explicitly about technology and sound design, though Flylo is clearly that, the cutting edge of that in America right now, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of that is picking up on space jazz, right? Some people call it ecstatic jazz or free jazz.
What is that?
Well, you know, there's that period in the 60s when jazz just sort of pulled away from the rigid kind of structures of bebop jazz. And you had people who were using Astral Traveling is an album by John Coltrane, right? Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of people using these themes of outer space because they're exploring through sound alternate imaginary spaces for Black people.
Yeah, and speaking of themes of space, I have been reintroduced to George Clinton recently. And I've just been listening to songs other and including, of course, Atomic Dog.
If Sun Ra is one of the primary figures, George Clinton is the other one. And the third one would be the Jamaican producer, Lee Scratch Perry.
Lee Scratch Perry Starship. Marcus Garvey Starship.
In fact, in the early days of Afrofuturism, just after Mark Derry had written that essay, those interviews where he coined the term Afrofuturism, another cat named John Corbett put together a piece called Brothers from Another Planet.
Yeah.
In which he talked about, you know, Sun Ra, George Clinton, Lee Scratch Perry. And he asked this question: how is it that these three Black men from different parts of the planet, totally different cultural experiences, all arrived at creating an ideology in which Black people are from outer space? And how do they create that in their music?
I mean, but what is the answer to that question?
Yeah, what is the answer?
For you, what is the answer to that question? How did these three Black men from arrive at this same idea?
My interpretation of it is the desire to break away from all the constraints of Western culture, white culture, European culture, and their own access to studio technologies that they thought of as, you know, allowing them to create new sounds and create new worlds, right? And the fact that I'm pretty sure that they all read or watched a lot of sci-fi. You know, when Greg Tate said, being Black is like a science fiction experience, right? In which aliens came and took you from your planet and brought you to another planet forcibly, genetically modified you to adapt to their new planet, right? He said, that's a science fiction experience. Lee Perry, Sun Ra, George Clinton, in very different ways, saw that. And they told that story in their music.
We'll have to leave it there, Louis. This is so much fun. Thank you so much for all this wisdom and all this music that we're now going to go listen to.
Oh, please dig in. There's so much. This is not even the tip of the iceberg. This is the tip of the tip.
Well, if you want to jam out to some of this, if you want to try to get a flavor of it, you can check out Louis' curated playlist. We'll have a link in our show notes on our website. And hey, happy Black Future Month to everybody.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for this.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Do check out Louis' playlist. It's got this song on it, The Chant by Ibibio Sound Machine, as well as some of the other songs we talked about and many, many more. Our own theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band, sound designed by Jared Paul. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frillman, and Kusha Navadar. And I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright or email me at anxiety@wnyc.org. Send us your voice memos about anything you've heard. Maybe you've got a favorite Afrofuturistic song you want to chime in about. Tell us about it. And as always, please do join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at wnyc.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves. Happy Black History Month.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.